So he did what the Lord had told him. He went to the Kerith ravine, east of the Jordan, and stayed there. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. Sometime later, the brook dried up, because there had been no rain in the land. Then the word of the Lord came to him. Go at once to Zarephath in the region of Sidon, and stay there. I have instructed a widow there to supply you with food. So he went to Zarephath. When he came to the town gate, a widow was there gathering sticks. He called to her and asked, Would you bring me a little water in a jar so I may have a drink? As she was going to get it, he called, And bring me please a piece of bread. As surely as the Lord your God lives, she replied, I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little olive oil in a jug. I am gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die. Elijah said to her, Don't be afraid. Go home and do as you have said. But first, make me a small loaf. Make a small loaf for me from what you have and bring it to me. And then make something for yourself and your son. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord sends rain on the land. So she went away and did as Elijah had told her. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman and her family, for the jar of flour was not used up, and the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. Sometime later, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill. He grew worse and worse and finally stopped breathing. She said to Elijah, What do you have against me, man of God? Did you come here to remind me of my sin and kill my son? Give me your son, Elijah replied. He took him from her arms, carried him to the upper room where he was staying, and laid him on his bed. Then he cried out to the Lord, Lord, my God, have you brought tragedy even on this widow I am staying with by causing her son to die? Then he stretched himself out on the boy three times and cried out to the Lord, Lord, my God, let this boy's life return to him. The Lord heard Elijah's cry, and the boy's life returned to him, and he lived. Elijah picked up the child and carried him down from the room to the into the house. He gave him to his mother and said, Look, your son is alive. Then the woman said to Elijah, Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is the truth.
Morning all. I'd like to start, if I can, with a little bit of a fun experiment. And you are going to need to put your hands up. Sorry. I'm going to put a word up on the screen, and I want you just, in a short space of time, to think about what the main meaning of that word is for you. Okay, let's go. If I can do the right arrow, and it's not doing anything, nor is that. That's interesting. Was that me or you, John? Right. Okay. Word. What does that mean? I hope it is switched on. Yay. That's just some suggestions I had. And there's a something else option at the bottom. Very, very briefly. Okay. Lightning. So, hands up for who lightning is a weather phenomenon. Lots of you. Hands up for who lightning is a military aeroplane. There's a few more geeks in here. An animated talking car, perhaps if you've got young kids, McQueen, thank you. Or something else. Yeah, a few outriders as well, fantastic. Okay, but quite a lot of consistency, but not uniformity, brilliant. Okay, next word. Just have a think for a couple of seconds, and then here's some thoughts. Okay, mercury. Hands up. A liquid metal, liquid at room temperature. Lots of scientists. A planet. A few less. A rock singer. That was close to being there. Or something else. Fantastic. Okay, last one. OK, can you? Basil. And there's quite a lot of these, so I think there might be a few in something else here as well. Okay, basil, a herb. An incompetent hotel owner. An annoying, daft as a brush fox puppet. What about something else? Anyone something else? No one with Russian Orthodox background or anything like that? Okay, fantastic. So, let's go back one. The answers you had to all of those were all correct. But you would have been wrong to assume that every person next to you had the same answer. So assuming we know what a word means is dangerous. And assuming we all think the same way about something is even more dangerous. Especially when it's not just a bit of fun. My sermon title for today, Elijah's Compassion. That word, that C word, compassion, it's a great word, it's a great concept. It's an interesting word. I think it can be a dangerous word. First, because it's a word Christians use a lot, we think we know what it means, and we think we know what compassion looks like. Second, compassion. Compassion's a challenging word. Challenges us, and challenges us away from self-centeredness, so it hurts. So, are we afraid of the challenge? Are we a bit defensive about compassion? But there's a third danger, key danger, when we think about a word like compassion. We look at the stories in the Bible, we look at Jesus, we look at ourselves and we get down on ourselves because we think our little bits of compassion probably don't add up to very much. The danger is we focus on what we think we haven't done or can't do than what we can. And none of those three are what I want this morning. Compassion. It's interesting, the word compassion did not appear on that passage that Sally's just read to us, but it pervades right through it. And I want to look at that passage, that great passage, in its own terms and see what it can say to us about what compassion ought to look like for us. The passage is structured around two episodes while Elijah was staying with a widow in the town of Zarephath. The first episode, verses 10 to 15, is the day he arrives, the day he turns up and meets her for the first time. And the second one, verses 17 to 24, is another day, a bit further on, the most dramatic and eventful day of his whole stay. So episode 1, verse 5. Before Elijah gets there. At the start of our reading, he's being miraculously looked after by God in the Kerith Ravine. Now, Kerith Ravine, if you look at a map, it was just around the corner from where Elijah had come from, so it was home ground for him. Stability, security, safety, God was looking after him. But then, situation changes. The brook that had provided him with water dries up because, verse 7, there had been no rain. And that stopping of the rain was not just an unusual weather pattern. It was part of something much bigger. It was part of God's judgment on the nation of Israel, going back to how Ahab, their king, And the rest of the nation who'd followed him had turned away from God to follow not so much God, but other gods, particularly a god called Baal, who Ahab's wife Jezebel, who was the daughter of a guy called Ethbaal, who was the king of the Sidonians, she'd brought Baal with her. And so the country had turned away from God, and so God was punishing the country. Now, the brook would have dried up gradually, so I'm sure Elijah would have noticed and would have been praying to God, right, What are you going to do with me next? Where are you going to take me next? And we get that, verses 8 and 9. Then the word of the Lord came to him. Go at once to Zarephath of Sidon and stay there. I've commanded a widow in that place to supply you with food. God's got a plan. But because we're probably familiar with this passage, we miss possibly how shocking that plan is. Because this is God sending Elijah to an unlikely location. Zarephath of Sidon was about 100 miles away from Kerith, we reckon. And it was right across the other side of Israel and out the other side again. But it wasn't just anywhere outside Israel. It wasn't just a long way away physically. Remember who'd come from Sidon? Jezebel. God tells Elijah, I'm going to keep you safe. My plan for you now is to send you right into the middle of enemy territory, right where all this problem's come from. That's a really strange place to take Elijah. So an unlikely location and an unlikely supplier. I was wondering, and this is pure speculation, if on that 100-mile walk, Elijah was thinking about what this widow would be like. Maybe God was sending him all this way because she'd had a super rich husband who'd just died. And God had prepared all they owned specially for Elijah to look after him. Wow, that would be good. And that would be God showing his authority over Baal, wouldn't it? But the reality when he gets there could not be further from that. When Elijah asks the widow for drink and food, he discovers her true situation, verse 12. As surely as the Lord your God lives, she replied, I don't have any bread. I have hardly anything, she says. This widow, who Elijah's just gone on a long journey to meet, she has very little food. She has no faith in God. She obviously knows about him and kind of believes that he's real. Maybe there's a sort of competition between Yahweh and Baal going on here. But she certainly doesn't know him for herself. And she has no hope. Almost nothing. But Elijah has God's promise to him, that God has commanded the widow to supply him with food. Even though it looks like God hasn't actually told her that. That's interesting. He has God's word, and he also has his experience of what God has recently done for him through the ravens. God has already miraculously looked after him. So based on God's word and his recent experience of God's provision, he's still able to trust that despite what things look like, God will do what God has promised. But more than that, he realizes that he, Elijah, needs to be part of bringing that into being and making it happen. So he sees the widow, he hears her situation, and I think he asks himself, how can I help meet her need? Which, of course, in this case, would also help meet his need. And he brings a word, which is what he would do as a professional prophet. And he brings a word in three parts. He says, don't be afraid. Removing the fear from the situation, bringing God there and then. God is here. God is now. He says, go and do something. Don't stand there. Go do something. Bring action, including providing for others before herself. So obedience to God's command is a key part of what needs to be happening here. And the third part, bringing hope. This is what God says. The jar of flour will not be used up. The jug of oil will not run dry. Bringing hope where there was none. Encouraging the widow to trust God and his promises. So, verse 15, she went away and did what Elijah had told her, so there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman and for her family. God's provision miraculously demonstrated, not only for Elijah, but for a pagan widow, a nobody, if you like, in the heart of a pagan land. God can do anything, anywhere. Let's just think about what Elijah did here, how he helped her, how he showed compassion. When he saw her need, he assessed the situation and thought, right, with God's power, how can I help? So his understanding was working together with his faith and resulted in the appropriate action. There's no mention of an emotional element here. Doesn't mean it wasn't there. And Glyn pointed out something similar to this last week. There's actually no mention yet of him praying, but I'm sure he did. But in this episode of the story, I think what we're meant to take is that formula. Understanding plus faith leads to action. In this case, it was the appropriate action. So, Elijah, the widow, and her son enjoyed a time of stability, but then, suddenly, the situation changed again. Verses 17 and 18. Sometime later, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill. He grew worse and worse, and finally stopped breathing. She said to Elijah, "What do you have against me, man of God? Did you come here to remind me of my sin and kill my son?" The woman is full of emotion, obviously, and she doesn't understand. On the face of it, she's blaming Elijah, but I think she's really blaming herself. She's aware of her sin, it's interesting, but again, no hope, no way of dealing with it. She can't see that. And again, this is me speculating a bit, but maybe she'd seen her husband's death in some way as her fault. And so the only way of making up for that would be to successfully raise her son. And now that's been taken away. So is God telling her, you're not good enough and your time's run out? And I think what she's saying here is a deep question about God. What is God really like? Is God basically about judgment? You get it wrong, I punish you. Or is God really about grace, forgiveness, and restoration? Is Elijah's God, Yahweh, really any different from her God, Baal? Who's the true God? Elijah, rightly, doesn't give her a theology lesson here. How many of us would? Please, no. He sees her, he hears her situation, and asks himself again, I think, how can I meet her need? Like he had in episode one, but this time, it's very different. This time, he has no understanding of what's going on either. This time, he doesn't have a word from the Lord for her. So, unlike the first time, he's totally out of his professional prophet comfort zone. And so for Elijah here, emotion takes over from intellect. But critically again, emotion leads to action. And he brings God into the situation. We've got a slightly different formula going on here, I think. Emotion plus faith leads to action. And he cries out to the Lord. Oh, Lord, my God, let this boy's life return to him. I don't know what you think prayer looks like, but this is not calm and controlled prayer. This is Elijah overflowing, expressing himself in every part of his being, his emotion, his words, his body as well. Loudly passionate. Oh. And he's praying to God. What's he praying for? He's praying for a resurrection. And this is even more of an ask than we think it is. Because at this point in history, at this point in the Bible's timeline, God had done many miracles, saved many people from dying. No resurrections yet. Elijah was praying for something that had never happened before. Bigger, almost, than what anything God had done. So how was God going to respond? Well, verse 22. The Lord heard Elijah's cry, and the boy's life returned to him, and he lived. Elijah prayed that huge prayer for the first resurrection in world history, and God said, yes. Wow. What an amazing, powerful, caring God. Now, it'd be easy to look at this story and think, well, the application about prayer is obvious. If you run out of any other ideas, try praying. That's not the right interpretation of this passage whatsoever. Far better, I think, would be this. Always try praying, even if, or maybe even especially, when we've run out of other ideas. I think we learn two things from Elijah in this passage about the right way to show compassion, responding to what someone else needs. First, the right how will depend on the situation. Sometimes, like in episode one, our understanding, our knowledge, and it might be something really, really practical, not spiritual in any way, might be relevant, and we can help in an immediate and practical way. Sometimes, like in episode two, we have none of that. We have no understanding. Maybe we have lots of emotion. Sometimes, all we can do is bring what we have, might just be emotion, and pray. But we can, and always should, exercise our faith in God. Bring God into the situation, because that's what Elijah did in both situations through his faith in God. Because God has the big picture. God knows what's going on, even or especially when we don't. God is working out his purposes. And in this story, God's key purpose isn't just about meeting the immediate needs of Elijah and the widow for food. God's got a bigger and deeper thing going on here. And it's about this question: showing compassion, who? Why did God send Elijah all that way to a pagan nobody in the heart of Baal country? Yes, it would enable her physical needs to be met, but God knew that sending Elijah to her, more than that, would meet her real deepest need, would enable her to come to her own faith in the one true God. Because God's had compassion on her, and that was way big, way deep. God took the long view. And that's how she responded. Now I know. God knew that that's what was going to happen. That's what God was working towards. And God knew that this story of Elijah and the widow would echo through history as an example of how God changes lives. I'm on my last page, by the way. I know it's going on a bit. This story gets two mentions in the New Testament. Gets a mention from Jesus when he's speaking to the crowd in his hometown synagogue. "I tell you the truth, no prophet is accepted in his hometown. I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time when the sky was shut for 3.5 years and there was a severe famine in the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath in the region of Sidon." You've got to read the context of that a bit more, but the widow's response of faith in God, even though she was a pagan, although I don't think she was by the end of the story, was greater than the response of indifference or rejection from those who were meant to be God's people. And the second instance where this echoes directly, direct reference in the New Testament, is about Elijah's faith. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 35, as part of a long list of examples for Christians to copy. And in a section about the Old Testament prophets and how their faith led to all sorts of great things, we read, "Women received back their dead, raised to life again." And that follows Elijah's faith. Note that that's women, plural. Because there's a really similar story to this in 2 Kings chapter 4, a few chapters' time, where a woman has a dead son resurrected through the agency of a prophet, Elijah's successor, Elisha. Very similar story, but two very different women. In 2 Kings 4, she's not a pagan, she's an Israelite. She's married, not a widow. She's rich, not poor. Making the point that God's grace and God's power are available to absolutely everyone. Your race, your background, your social standing, no difference to God. Sorry. We live in a time where voices from all extremes of the political spectrum and from other places as well are encouraging us to divide people into those who are deserving and those who aren't. And I knew where this was going before I woke up on Friday morning. That's just the consequences, one example of where this attitude can lead to. Jesus told two parables where a key character, he explicitly says, a key character has compassion. Only two in Jesus' parables. And both of them were a direct response to religious experts who were dividing people into those who were deserving and those who weren't. Parable of the Good Samaritan, Luke chapter 10, 33, we read, "But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where the man was, and when he saw him, he had compassion." Other than the example of Jesus himself, perhaps the strongest example Jesus gave us of how what our attitude should be to other people. Showing compassion how? However we can. Showing compassion who? Anyone we can, whoever they are. So, sensitively, in love, challenge. Are there any types of people who you find it difficult to show compassion towards simply because of who they are? The other parable is the parable of the prodigal son. Luke chapter 15, verse 20. "But while the son was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced and kissed him." If you've got an NIV, incidentally, it doesn't translate that quite the same, but the word is compassion. It's the same word. The Good Samaritan illustrates what our attitude should be, and the father of the prodigal son, of course, illustrates what God's attitude always is. God is always about grace, forgiveness, and restoration. God always has compassion. So, who is around you? Who do you see? Whose situation do you hear? How can you help? Is it through your expertise, through your understanding, plus faith? Or is it, that touches me, I care about that, I don't know what to do, plus faith? When you don't have any understanding, you can and always should bring your faith. Always show compassion and always try praying.